From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis on the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Jenna Gibson, Director of Communications at KEI, and I will be your host today. In this episode, we're talking with Ken Goss. He's the Director of International Affairs Group at CNA, a nonprofit research and analysis organization. He is also the author of a new book, North Korean House of Cards, Leadership Dynamics Under Kim Jong-un, which was published this fall through the Committee for Human Rights in North Korea. Ken, thank you very much for joining us today.
Nice to be here.
So to start off, I know we had you here on Korean Context in 2012, and obviously a lot of things have changed in North Korea since then. Mm-hmm. Can you give us some of the key changes that have shaped the North in the past 3 years or so?
Well, I mean, I wouldn't say necessarily that, you know, what we talked about in 2012 is necessarily out of sync with what we're seeing today, but we're now beginning to put together a pattern of what is happening in North Korea. Kim Jong-il really created a nest for the succession. And the way that he did this was to try to merge the military first concept with the party center concept, the party center being the code word for the successor, and create, reinvigorate the party and infuse it with a large degree or percentage of military and security personnel as well as party personnel. But what we've been seeing over the last couple of years is a major purge primarily focused on the military, somewhat on the security apparatus, very limited, although somewhat recently, on the party apparatus. And what we see is the regime, I believe, while you're reinvigorating the party, you're recreating some of the formal institutions which would allow a very young leader to try to run the regime, you're also seeing, I think, a transfer in the ruling philosophy and dynamics within the regime away from military first to Donju first, where there is this growing elite within North Korea who I believe are having growing influence. And it's their growing expectations that I think that are governing a lot of Kim Jong-un's decision-making. And so what we're seeing is that the military has been essentially brought under the boot of the supreme leader, brought under control. They've had several turnovers in the key positions within the military, the Minister of People's Armed Forces, the Chief of the General Staff, the Director of the Operations Bureau, even the head of the General Political Bureau. This, in a way, I believe, weakened the military as a organization that could push back. Because I think in 2012, especially following the June measures, the military did push back. I think Lee Young-ho pushed back, and I think that was probably the primary reason why he was removed as the chief of the general staff. This is somebody who many people were pointing to after the third party conference in 2010 as being the kind of rising star and closest associate of Kim Jong-un, but you know, he was removed in 2012. So we have what we see is a major purging of the military. I think we also see in retrospect that there were clues to what was going to happen. And I think if you go back to the April 15th speech of 2012, which was Kim Jong-un's first speech on the anniversary, 100th anniversary of the birth of his grandfather, Kim Il-sung, he talked primarily about the economy. He talked about the non-belt tightening or moving away from the belt tightening, which is code, you know, for some sort of economic improvement measures. But I think he also had a couple of other things that he needed to do as the supreme leader. He, one, needed to conduct politics within the regime. That means moving people around and bringing in people close to him, beginning the beginnings of a generational shift, which we're still waiting to see play out. He also wanted to show progress on the critical defense systems, which he did in December 2012 with the missile launch, and in February of 2013 with the third nuclear test. But the one thing that he hasn't shown much progress is on the economy. And I think that's what's governing a lot of what we're seeing in terms of the politics, the shift, the changing around, the personnel movements within the leadership, and probably the governing issues that are governing Kim Jong-un's decision-making. And I would argue that now, really since August, when we had the crisis on the peninsula, you ask, why would they do that? after, going through this diplomatic charm campaign, which began in May of 2013. And I think the belief was there that the charm campaign was not working, so that they would move more toward a brinksmanship strategy. Why? Because they need to engage South Korea, because that's the economic engine that they need to link into in order to realize the strong and prosperous nation. If you look at it, the model from that perspective, the evolution from 2010, when Kim Jong-un makes his first appearance as the heir apparent, to today, really kind of makes logical sense that they are moving from the governing philosophy of Kim Jong-il being military first to something else that is probably primarily centered, I believe, on the economy. And that's what's driving his decision making these days. And that's what's driving the politics and what we're seeing happening inside North Korea.
That's a definite important shift within North Korea, of course. And another major changing point that you also mentioned in your book and that people really talk about a lot is the execution of Chung Sung-taek and this kind of pre-execution and post-execution. Do you see that as a major turning point? Do you think that that has had a lot of effect on North Korean leadership?
I think it was definitely a watershed moment in the Kim Jong-un era. But if you look at the model I just laid out, it makes perfect sense. It fits in there nicely. It's not a dramatic break from 2010 to what we see now. And how's that? Why would that be? Well, basically, if you were changing the governing philosophy within the regime from military first to something else, maybe Donju first, you go after elements of the military, you go after people at the very senior elements of the party and the security apparatus, and very senior elements around Kim Jong-un. These are the people that made up parts of the regent structure and key advisors. When you do that, you create instability at the top of the regime. And when you do that, there is potential for people to begin to cause mischief at the top or take advantage of the situation. And I believe this is something that Chung Sung-taek was doing. I believe that he had at least been building an empire going back to 2008 with Kim Jong-il's stroke. And I believe the empire was centered on the administrative department, and it was drawing resources from the military, the security apparatus, as well as the organization guidance department and key parts of the party apparatus. They were bringing in hard currency operations. But the thing that where he really made his mistake is that this was not tied into the royal economy, which funds the Kim family. And if you assume that a key thing that Kim Jong-un needed to do to consolidate power was to coalesce the funding and increase the funding within the royal economy to make up for his lack of legitimacy and experience within the regime, then the narrative begins to make sense. He is needing to spend more money within the regime to buy largesse. The royal economy is weakening. There is instability at the top, and here's Chung Sung-taek potentially building a power behind the throne or an alternative center of power within the regime. And if you take that to be the case, then it explains why Kim Jong-un probably had to divest himself of Chung Sung-taek in a very dramatic way earlier, probably, than what he wanted to do. I think this was driven by the fact that Kim Jong-un probably had some sort of an ailment, maybe a minor stroke in 2012 that led to the investigation that uncovered some of this activity. And, Kim Jong-un could not have the second echelon of power basically in a major power struggle going on while he's trying to consolidate his power. And apparently, I believe that Chung Sung-taek was really causing a lot of that. And that when he was sent to China in 2012 to secure Kim family funds out of the Chinese banks and did not come back with the money, that then led to suspicions within the Kim family itself, mainly Kim Jong-hui and Kim Jong-un, about his trustworthiness. And so, therefore, if you look at it in that perspective, within that model, with these dynamics at play, something like a purge of Chung Sung-taek makes sense. I think many Pyongyang watchers were expecting that it would take place at some point, maybe in the 2015 timeframe or something like that. The fact that it came in 2013 was a surprise. But I believe that Chung Sung-taek's fate was probably sealed maybe not his execution, but his fate was probably sealed before Kim Jong-il's death. This was probably something that he conveyed to his sister and possibly even to Kim Jong-un, that he could not fully consolidate his power as long as Chang Son-taek, who was operating as the control tower within the regime, continued to play a fundamental role within the regime.
You just mentioned the term control tower, which I know comes up a lot in your book as well. Do you see a new control tower emerging, or how is that role being played now that Chang Son-taek is gone?
Well, the traditional control tower within the regime has always been the supreme leader. Basically, Chang Son-taek was, I think, given this role because of Kim Jong-un's inexperience and dealing with the bureaucracy and the day-to-day management of the regime. With the execution or the elimination of Chang Son-taek, I believe what has happened is that you have seen a growth in Kim Jong-un's personal secretariat, personal apparatus, that is now really beginning to accommodate the role of the control tower. And you're beginning, I believe, to see decision-making that is made by Kim Jong-un fairly similar or moving back toward the way that it was done under Kim Jong-il, in which there would be the liaison between his personal apparatus and the party apparatus. And that, you know, options and ideas and policy issues would be filtered up for his decision. He probably does have a group of advisors around him that advise him to greater or lesser extent. I believe that sometimes he takes the advice, sometimes he doesn't. I think on those issues that are existential to his position, I think that he does listen to that. Things that are less existential can kind of waver back and forth or be delayed, or a lot of things I believe that we see in the diplomatic arena, you know, send the Murabong band to China, then bring it back, or do other things that could suggest that there is a inexperience at the helm of decision making, especially in those decisions that are less important to his own position within the regime. I think that he has shown actually quite pragmatic and skilled hand so far in terms of crisis decision making. We saw that in 2013 to a certain extent, where they did not go to provocation. They were able to keep that somewhat under control, although I think the U.S. had a role in that by not testing the Minuteman missile. But we also saw it in August. I believe that this was a planned out strategy for engagement with South Korea. And if in fact that was the plan, although I think they were probably thrown off their game by the loudspeaker situation, I believe that they ultimately got what they wanted, which was engagement with South Korea. But of course, they were hoping that South Korea would come to the negotiating table with a broader perspective, especially on Mount Kumgon. And I think that they probably are now thinking seriously, do we continue to try to engage with South Korea? And there's some evidence that they're going to continue that. Or are we going to see a movement toward more provocation and brinksmanship strategy, which I think that'll be critical set of decisions that we will see over the next several months leading up to the joint exercises in March and April, Key Resolve and Full Eagle. They conduct something earlier than that, a nuclear test, a missile test, or another aggressive provocation, it would suggest that they're going down that avenue. If they hold off, then potentially we're seeing that they're continuing to try to engage South Korea. South Korea is the focus of North Korean foreign policy. No matter what they do with the Russians, the Chinese, the United States, it's the South Koreans that are the focus.
Great. So far we've talked a lot about the, I guess, structural style of the Kim Jong-un regime. How about his personal style as a leader? How would you describe his personal style? How does he differ from his father and his grandfather?
He's a third model. I mean, he's definitely closer to his grandfather than he was his father. I mean, his father, we only heard like 12 seconds of public speaking out of Kim Jong-il at a military parade. Under Kim Jong-un, he seems to feel growingly comfortable speaking in public. His mannerisms are reminiscent of Kim Il-sung. But whereas Kim Il-sung had the natural legitimacy and the experience and things to go along with being a leader, Kim Jong-un is still learning that role, and I believe that he has a personality that is somewhat bombastic, that is somewhat mercurial at times, especially I suspect that he doesn't like hearing bad news. But again, it comes back to the type of advice and information that he's receiving. If it's stuff that is information that is critical to his position within the regime, I think that he takes that very seriously and probably acts on it very pragmatically. If, on the other hand, it is information that is less important to his position, I think that he will tend to, kind of make decisions from the gut. But again, a lot of people talk about that decision making from the gut being, they point to the ski slopes and the theme parks. And but if we go back to the model being that the Donju first possibility, well, it makes sense then. They need a place to be able to, to relax and celebrate their wealth. These are potential areas that for tourism that, I think that North Korea has given a lot of indication that they want to bring in hard currency through tourism. So it's not as insane as some people tend to make it out to be. It kind of makes sense. But yet he does have this tendency, I think, to kind of waffle on certain policies, go back and forth. And I think this regime, because you have a certain nervousness at the top of the regime with the purges such as Chae Long-hae and others, that there's a certain nervousness about providing advice to him on certain issues, and that can lead to decision making that is not necessarily well informed. And so you kind of get this back and forth sort of decision making, which I think with a inexperienced leader that needs a kind of a framework around him and good information coming in for him to make good decisions, that's not always there on particular decisions.
So, as most of our listeners are aware, North Korea announced that they'll be holding the 7th Workers' Party Congress next year. It's the first in more than 30 years. How do you see this playing into some of the dynamics that you have been describing?
The issue of the 7th Party Congress, again, I think, if we take the model that we're looking at and really going to, beginning really in 2014, leading up to now, I think that he has been trying to drive a resolution with the relationship with South Korea and to a lesser extent with the United States towards something that's going to mean a fundamental change in North Korea's relationship with the outside world. That means security guarantees, that means, international aid without strings attached to the nuclear issue, which of course they have not been able to pull off. But I think the idea of putting the Seventh Party Congress out there was a way that we have two options of what could actually happen here. The first option is that North Korea succeeds in its diplomatic charm campaign, gets what they want, or provocation campaign, depending on, what direction they go. And they get what they want, especially out of the South Koreans, but maybe also out of the United States. That party congress could be a venue in which he really opens up a major fundamental changes in policy, maybe even a realignment of Pyongyang, more focusing on the economy and less on the nuclear issue. That's a theory. So it could be a venue, and part of the reason why a party congress versus a party conference is something where you could make fundamental policy changes and not just personnel changes or some tweaking to the party charter or something in a congress. You could actually fundamentally go after some of these strategic guidelines which were laid down under Kim Jong-il. If, on the other hand, that it doesn't pay off and they are basically stuck in this catch-22 of Pyongyang and they don't get what they want, then I think it's probably going to be a propaganda affair. They'll lay out some sort of propaganda line that focuses more on something like Juche or how they have to struggle and things like that, and tout his wisdom as a leader. So I think that really that Seventh Party Congress is a way of really kind of a milestone. It could really be the unveiling of a new regime with a new governing philosophy that supports the Kim Jong-un era, or it could be some sort of propaganda facsimile thereof. So we're just going to have to see. We don't know what. I don't think they even know what the fundamental, you know, statement that's going to come out of that party Congress. I believe we will have a lot of personnel changes, potentially a lot of personnel changes. That actually will be something interesting to watch. If they don't, if they leave the current crowd basically in place, then it would suggest that Kim Jong-un still is working on the consolidation process. If all of a sudden we start to see a lot of names and people that is coming up from the latter half of the third generation, the fourth generation, up to senior parts of the formal leadership, then that could really suggest that he has gone a long way toward his consolidation.
I'm curious about the title of your book, North Korean House of Cards. And how did you decide on that title? And what ways do you see the North Korean leadership similar to a House of Cards?
Well, actually, that was the publisher's idea. But it does see, I mean, it obviously references the television series and the British and the American series of basically these, you know, the Machiavellian machinations behind the scenes, which is really the part and parcel of a totalitarian regime. And I mean, I've studied totalitarian regimes most of my working life. I've had discussions with people who were part of the Stalinist regime back in the day. And there is this whole kind of soap opera that really takes place behind the scenes that is involving a lot of the key families and figures around the leader. In this case, Kim Jong-un. And these people and a lot of these kind of little power plays and relationships that exist around the leader drives a lot of what we see in policy. That's why I would argue that we are moving away from a military first to something like a Donju first, because I think a lot of these people, these very young generation, many of them, offspring of former leaders within North Korea who are running a lot of these hard currency operations, a lot of these have ties into Kim Jong-un, his brother Kim Jong-chol. So it's more important to understand that little kind of patent place aspect of the regime than it is to think about North Korea and what their strategic equities are in the region vis-a-vis China, the United States, South Korea, because it's that stuff that goes on behind the scenes that is, I believe, much more important to how the supreme leader thinks about the world, the lens through which he views his own regime, his own place in the regime, the relationships with the outside parties and things, is all through the prism of these various relationships that exist around him. And that really kind of fits into this whole narrative of a house of cards. But then there's the other aspect of it, which really raises the question, the issue of stability within North Korea. Because in a house of cards, a house of cards can be fairly stable, but you know, if you remove a particular card at a particular place within the stack, it can cause a cascading effect. So while it can be very strong or appear to be strong, it can be at the very same time very fragile. And especially as you're going into a third generational succession change, where the leader is further away from the issues of legitimacy within the regime, that these relationships and which are very perishable, as we've seen over the last couple of years, that North Korea could at some point become unstable. And my belief is that he has like 2 to 5 years to complete the consolidation process. And if that doesn't happen, I believe that there are dynamics that are going to be unleashed in this regime that could potentially change his role within the regime from being the dictator to some maybe potentially a consensus builder or maybe potentially a puppet. And if that were to happen, the culture of the regime, I believe, will not sustain a collective leadership or anything other than a supreme leader and probably a Kim as a supreme leader. And that could be very disastrous for this regime in terms of its stability.
Your book is incredibly detailed. There's an impressive amount of information about the leadership and the leadership structure. I'm curious what you hope this level of detail and the understanding of these kind of intricacies, as you've described, what can that bring to the table in terms of understanding North Korea, but also in terms of responding to them?
Well, it kind of gives you a sense, I believe, about the boundaries and drivers behind the leadership. what will drive them, and what are the boundaries in which they will operate in. And if you use the model that he is still trying to consolidate his power, there are basically three models out there about how the North Korean regime runs. One is that he became the supreme leader from day one when he assumed the titles of power, and that just by the culture of the regime, he is the, you know, he has stepped into the shoes of his father and grandfather. And there seems to be a lot of evidence that that's not the case. The other one is obviously the one that has come out of defector circles, talking about the Organization Guidance Department as the power and the puppeteer behind the throne. That there are a lot of problems, I believe, with that. And then the third one is that he, while he is the ultimate decision maker and he is the supreme leader, he has not fully consolidated his power. And if you use that as the model, you could then begin to build off of, and looking at a lot of the, you know, the link ups and relationships within the regime, you could begin to construct the boundaries in which he makes decisions, in which he operates. He cannot make fundamental strategic decisions such as denuclearization, because it would fundamentally undermine his ability to consolidate his power. And so by having the understanding of the leadership dynamics, not only the who's who in the zoo sort of stuff, but more importantly, the environment in which these people operate, you can begin to understand the latitude that the supreme leader has to react to external stimuli. And so therefore that should be able to help inform whatever policies you have and give you some level of confidence about what North Korea's reactions will be to whatever initiatives that you may put forward or whatever pressure you try to exert. And I think so far, the model that I've just laid out, the third model there, that he's not consolidating his power, really answers all of the questions and really kind of explains why North Korea has done some of the things that they have done.
As I mentioned, it's an impressively detailed book and a great read to understand the leadership dynamics in North Korea today. So thank you very much for being here.
Glad to be here.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. Thank you so much for joining us, and we hope to see you again next time.